Thank you, Craig, and thank you to the American Scientific Affiliation for holding this wonderful conference that allows us to explore sacred custodial realms with the discovery, the intrigue, the curiosity, the dimensions of science that unfold before our very ears, before our very eyes in this universe. And thank you to my fellow presenters. I've learned a great deal from Keith and from Leslie and from Craig. And thank you to the audience for being here today. Established it all like a changeless decree, and rounded, then cast, like a mantle, the sea. The case that came before the Supreme Court in oral argument, October 8, 2008, and was adjudicated by said court, November 12, 2008, has to do with two salient issues related to both secular and sacred custodial realms. I'm speaking of Winter, Secretary of the Navy, et al., versus Natural Resources Defense Council. In this fascinating case, the interests of military training versus the interests of environmental protection came into play. I'm going to contrast today those two decisions on four grounds, those being origin, philosophy, purpose, and policy. If we go to the origin of the case, if we look at the close decision, a 5-4 decision, the majority written by Chief Justice Roberts, and the dissenting opinion written by Justice Ginsburg and Justice Souter dissenting. As we look at those two cases in terms of origin philosophy, purpose, and policy, first of all, with respect to origin, case stasis. That is, what is the question that the two sides are asking and answering? Now, we presume when we teach debate, as you were just talking about in terms of public policy and the import of engaging a lively public debate, when we teach debate academically, we are very insistent that the question that the parties be addressing, the affirmative and the negative teams, be exactly the same resolved. Even a deviation of a pronoun would be an illegitimate debate as constructed academically, because even that one word could change the meaning and the stance and the basis upon which that decision was made. It's very interesting when we visit Winter, Secretary of the Navy et al. Versus Natural Resources Defense Council, that indeed a different case question is advanced by the majority and by the dissent. In the case of the majority, the case stasis. The case question is, what is necessary to protect national security? Answering that question, understandably, arrives at a different response set than does the case stasis question posed by the dissent. And that question is, was procedure followed? Was environmental protection procedure, as stipulated by NEPA, satisfied? And because we have two different questions, we have two different answers. In the origin of those cases, we also see a different structural argumentation advanced to support both. In the case of Roberts writing for the majority, we have a structure that is a causal expository structure. So what are the factors that lead to a secure nation? What is at stake in securing the nation's waters? What is at stake in securing the nation's military warning system vis-a-vis sonar training? What is at stake? And then the opinion goes on to correlate very closely that what is at stake has to have a very certain set of policies attached to that national security interest. In the origin case of the dissent led by Justice Ginsburg, we see a chronological expository structure being advanced that relates very closely to that case stasis of procedure. So in the beginning of her opinion, and really toward about the middle of her opinion, Justice Ginsburg writes about the chronology that normally should occur when parties are going to determine what is necessary to proceed when you make any action, undertake any action that is going to impact the environment. And in this case, the question becomes, when an EA is administered, that is an environmental assessment, which is a more overlaid, broad look at the landscape, when an EA is administered, that is determinative of whether an EIS is necessary. And that EIS, then, that environmental impact statement, becomes a more detailed report. So you do the EA in order to determine, do we need more specific information? Do we need to glean that information? Is an EIS in order before we proceed? Now, Justice Ginsburg's contention was that the Navy went ahead either before said statements were undertaken or completed, or in conjunction with the training exercises, the 14 exercises conducted in SoCal off, of course, the coast of California, whether or not those were conducted simultaneously with or prior to the completion of the EA and, most importantly, the EIS. So you see the two proceeding differently, and they proceed differently in part because they've selected a different point of origin for those cases to advance. Then we go on to philosophy. What is the philosophy governing the cases? And in this rhetorical analysis, I look at Kenneth Burke's dramatistic Pentad. Kenneth Burke, a scholar in sociology, linguistics, and English, decided that one useful way to view the way that people map how they view the world, how they position their priorities, is through a sense of the dramatic. And by dramatic, I don't mean that you stage something that has those choreographed components, but really any of the ways that we use language reveals that we have a particular value set in place. So if we talk about the scene, where something is going to occur, we've talked about being here in Waco, we've talked about the surrounding dinosaur exploratory areas that Ian investigated so diligently. We talk about those various areas that we have, and when we are engaged in the where and the when of the action, that shows us that we have a philosophy that is geared toward the materialistic conditions of a particular locale. And I would imagine the geological kinds of surveys have to be very materialistically oriented to look at those Permian limestone formations and to try to discover what those particular areas are. So when we are particularly concerned with where does something occur, when does something occur, we're revealing a philosophy that goes along with those material elements, those conditions that are put into place. When we look at who is involved, we are looking specifically at what kinds of characters are in command of the action. So who is doing the action, by whose authority, with what expertise, with what interpretive skills are they commencing their action? And not only do we talk about all of our policies in those kinds of terms, but we give one or more of them priority. So we might have a scenic orientation related to materialism. We might have an agentic orientation correlated with idealism. We might have an actional orientation concerned with realism. That is, what do we do? Do we track through sonar? If so, how far out materialistically do we need to circumference the area that sonar testing is going to occur in? Or in the case of the injunction that was established for the Navy to cease and desist within certain ranges of that activity, you begin to see how those correlates apply, how those scenic elements, those materialistic elements. The Navy was looking at a 2,200 area, 2,200 feet area, of when and where that action would occur. So if they saw marine mammals within that particular region, then they would cut back or cease their training activities. And now in the injunction that the Environmental Protection Agency and the other parties to the dissent asked for originally, they said that's not going to do it. You are going to have to come into much closer surroundings and look at specifically what that harm is going to do. And the Navy was saying at first, well, within 200 feet, if they appear within 200 feet, then that's a signal for us to not do the sonar testing at that particular time. And that goes strictly to the activity. Well, why not do the sonar testing? What is the objection to the sonar testing? What is the objection to that particular activity that the Navy maintains is absolutely critical? Why? Well, to be able to detect, track, neutralize any incoming craft, amphibian craft, submarines, etc. It's absolutely necessary to be able to detect through this active sonar, this mid-frequency range sonar, absolutely critical to be able to detect where that's occurring. And we can't, says the Navy, stop our exercises or cut back on our exercises. If we're to have realistic activity, realistic training, war preparedness, then we simply cannot cut back on these activities. We can't move the scene in to that level. We want it more broadly construed of what we're able to do. And so it became a case then that the environmental concerns object to, because according to the evidence that they submitted to the court, we have significant evidence and arguably substantial evidence and perhaps even irreparable evidence or irreparable harms caused to these sea creatures, including dolphins, whales, sea lions. And we see that they're being impacted. We see lesions. We see the various of their apparatus not functioning as they ought to. We see all of these different things occurring. And it might be much like the activity of a diver who gets the bends when they go below the surface, that it's disorienting, that the whales and other sea creatures might surface much too quickly and lose their sense of directionality, lose their sense of how they inhabit the sea. And so that nature of the activity, is it the sonar training? And does that sonar training interfere with, does it impact that life? And if so, what do we do about it? Then as we go on to the next element in Burke's PENTAD, we've talked about the scene, the act, the agents involved. Then there's also the element of agency. That is how the act is performed, through what methods, through what mechanisms, through what vehicles, perhaps through what technology that's occurring, and what is the nature of that technology. And we see different sets of language, different rhetorical choices used to portray both sonar training as an agency and being able to use the agency of precautionary measures, as argued by the dissent, in order to do something much differently with that. And then purpose. What do we do if we have this origin, we have this philosophy, and then we have this purpose? How do we define what the purpose is? And quite clearly, if you look at the case as adjudicated by Chief Justice Roberts, that case is one of war preparedness, being convinced by the Navy and their representatives legally that sonar training is the only way to make these detections for security purposes, and secondly, that it's the optimal way, that really there is no other means of detection, no other means of tracking, no other means of neutralizing except for this activity and this agency of sonar. And if war preparedness, if national security really is the issue and sonar training is the only way, the optimal way to secure that objective, then that is what must go forth. On the other hand, according to the dissent, the purpose is procedural protocol, that there are in place legislated ways to guard the environment. there are in place agencies specifically established with procedural policy directed toward what may and may not be done, regardless if you are a member of the military or not, what may or may not be done as you intrude upon the planet. And these environmental assessments and these environmental impact statements are not to be cast aside lightly, that they are not to be disregarded or discarded, that they must be followed in order to determine what is going on. And in the oral argument, it's really very interesting at one point when they're talking about environmental impact and the military, one of the justices brings up the question, well, but the whole result typically of war, active combat, does the opposite of preserve the environment? Typically it destroys. Such. So does an environmental impact statement, you don't do an environmental impact statement before you go into a combat zone and deploy your troops and have them carry out their mission. So in this sense, looking at this as deploying something, it wouldn't be nonsensical to do an environmental impact statement. And they tried to correlate the training conditions as similar to combat preparedness conditions and make that linguistic correlation, that it makes no more sense to do an environmental impact statement there than it would as if you were sending your troops into combat. You're not going to deploy them or not deploy them depending on how much shrubbery they might destroy or how many lizards might not survive that particular impact. So it becomes a very, very interesting case question as articulated by the two parties involved. So which should supersede the other? Does the Navy supersede NEPA as advanced by the majority, or does the NEPA supersede Navy as advanced by the dissent? And that's really the set of case questions that you're asked. They're established through language. They're established through argument structure, and hence they are rhetorical choices. So looking at the same body of evidence, asking and listening to the same questioners, interlocutors in the case as represented by advocates Gar and Kendall in the case, as you look at those two interlocutors and the questions that went out to them from the justices and the responses that they gave, you see very clear rhetorical indications of what the court's ruling might be. And then when it comes to policy, when we look at the policy, how do we proceed? What do we do? How do we make that case? Does the injunction established by the circuit court for the Navy's training, or rather to delimit the Navy's training, that if they are at this certain range, if they, for example, get in to 1,000-foot territory, then they have to decibel it down by 6. If they get within 500 feet, they have to decibel down the sonar emissions to a lower volume, about 10, and if they get within 200, then they have to cease it entirely. What do we do, and how do we decide that? And in this case, in this 5-4 ruling, the Navy did prevail in their argumentation. I think it is very interesting to look at these interests, because these are scientific questions. This is scientific evidence on both sides, on the sides of the military and on the sides of the environmental protection interests, that tell us about our national security and tell us what we can do about our environment. So it weighs very closely, very carefully, two different plausibilities, two different sets of policies that are issued, two different choices that are before people as they legislate about these issues, as they adjudicate about these issues, and as they understand these issues. So for us, as the American Scientific Affiliation, how do we get involved with these kinds of issues? What can we contribute? Because regardless of the evidence, it is evidence that is going to be extrapolated from a wider body. Not everything that is submitted, of course, in the research and the briefs is going to make the final cut of what the justices pay particular attention to. It's not going to make the final cut of the opinion. So in that sense, in the sense of selecting, arranging, apportioning, those kinds of issues, you have clearly choices that go to the very interests of national waters, international waters, domain, and the interests of protecting that sacred custody of our environment. So established at fast, like a changeless decree, and round it then cast, like a mantle, the sea. In winter, Secretary of the Navy et al. Versus NRDC. Thank you.
We got at least 5 minutes for questions.
Oh, good. Yes.
So in your mind, who should have prevailed?
I don't make it my mission to decide that. I make it my mission to best lay out what bases both sides advance for their case so that others looking at it might have a clear understanding of what the case question was that was resolved, the language and the structure of argumentation surrounding that, so that those people in those positions will be clearly able to discern between the two. Thank you. Yes.
What was your role? Did you, in this case, did you actually provide inputs to the Supreme Court, or was your role just analyzing the debate and results?
Analyzing the debate and analyzing the results. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
I was curious whether they used the same highly structured approach to analyzing the case that you did.
Oh well, thank you.
Not.
Thank you very much. Well. It is interesting to go through and try to discern the major tenets of the arguments that tend to mm-hmm. prevail on both sides. But thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you for that. Are you sure you don't live in Washington, D.C.?
Last I checked, my address still has an 80634 zip code. But
well, you need to come next year and share something like this. This is great. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I know you're not in the position to render your opinion on this, but I used to work in the field of Navy underwater acoustics and sonar,
mm-hmm.
all right,
mm-hmm.
So kind of familiar with the issues involved mm-hmm. here mm-hmm. and the technicalities of this. But I also recall, in general, other similar kinds of issues, and we've had some of them written up in our journal.
Mm-hmm.
On different issues like this, and I have to just say, as a general stewardship principle that you might add to your list of stewardship principles, that I think that we need to err on the side of the people or the creatures that can't speak for themselves.
Okay.
As advocates, watchdogs, whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm.
For those who can't speak for themselves,
mm-hmm.
because the Navy has an unlimited budget to go mm-hmm. to the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
and they sure used it mm-hmm. in this case.
Mm-hmm.
They had all kinds of scientific experts on their side and technical data that they could pull out, but actually we don't really know too much about the hearing of particular species of whales or something.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very little research on that, and it's mm-hmm. very difficult to do that kind of research on any creature.
Well, it is difficult, and then when you think of the causal correlations that have to be made,
mm-hmm.
was it sonar that was yeah. causing mm-hmm. these kinds of disorientations?
Mm-hmm. They argued against it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was ironic also that all this stuff emerged after the Cold War was over.
Yes.
Yeah. And where was the threat?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
the Navy for a long time was casting about looking for a threat because all the kinds of missions went slack. They didn't know how they would justify their existence.
Yeah, that's what they're trying to do.
Well, I think you make a very good point about creatures who can't speak. Yes, that's a very good point, and I will certainly add that to the paper I'm working on. I think that's a very, very good point. Thank you. Thank you. And particularly with your military experience, thank you. Yes.
Some of this is, you know, how much technology, just because you got it, doesn't mean you have to use it. And this goes on with medicine all the time. But, you know, if we invent something super sonar and it makes half the people deaf that live along the beach, well, maybe we've got to back off here. And obviously we're rating humans higher than the mammals in the sea, or some laser defense thing that blinds a bunch of airline pilots.
Reminds me of a point. You know, the founder of ASA, Alton Everest, worked in this field of sonar, water acoustics in the early days of that. So there's a connection that goes way back in this.
Oh, good. And then, too, you raise the question, well, how much, just because we have the technology, do we need to use it? And the Navy's argument is that you have to train under these realistic conditions, and interruptions within that training, ceasing of that training, there are these times when that training is particularly important, and to interfere with that is going to make people less mission ready to go out. So it's an interesting scenario to look at. Yes?
I wonder, in your analysis or in the case, or have you come across what the policies are of other countries that have, you know, sonar that they want to use but also have concerns about?
That wasn't brought into the case, but it does raise a very interesting question that has gone on recently with the hearings of Justice Sotomayor, or nominee Sotomayor. And if you look at those kinds of questions, it is, to what extent, if any, do we look at what other nations have done? But particularly when you're in these areas of environmental interest, it becomes something that you can't just map off the sea and say that it has no impact beyond this particular bound. So I think that's an excellent question. It was not brought up whatsoever, either in the oral argument or in the case itself. But it's an excellent question. Excellent question.
Surely the same dilemma, the same predicament would occur with other navies involved.
Right.
Just as concerned about protecting their own borders. So
right, and those collaborative efforts and what others are doing too.
They come up with alternatives, they're satisfied with. Well,
and part of that. Yeah, and then part of that becomes sharing of military information that would be a problem to collaborate too much on that. In that regard. Yes?
Just a comment on the possible threat of the military has a hard time detecting diesel submarines in shallow water, which are very quiet. So I felt that my imagination sort of run with it. I can envisage Tom Clancy constructing an entire plot around land, having done the research and the migration patterns of whales. Sneaking a sub along.
Of course, there are cocaine submarines, too, around the Central America now that are getting more sophisticated all the time. And other countries like India just recently got its first nuclear submarine. I mean, countries generally, I think nations generally, have a lust for nuclear power and submarines and high-tech weapons. There's just a general incredible lust for that kind of power everywhere.
Thank you. Yes.
I was just thinking of a couple things. That there is a strong limits on how much governments interact. I work for the Navy on the submarine board. We have a very close relationship with the British, but a very arm's length relationship with the French and the Canadians. And the modes of it, you know, what becomes an issue that you can't talk about. It's kind of unfortunate because we end up each inventing our own wheels. Sharing, that has changed somewhat, but there's still a tremendous amount. When you first started, I was trying to figure out what you were saying, that the two people were debating a different question. They did have the same question, but they approached it on a very different
Yes, and they don't say that explicitly, certainly not at the outset, but I did find evidence in both the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion, things prefaced with "the case before us is such and such," and two different versions of what the case.
Precisely the same.
Right, exactly. So giving priority to answering a slightly different question. Yes.
You have a last question.
Okay. We have two folks who work for the Navy here, and so this question is a little bit off subject, but I thought that the Navy had largely gone to passive sonar for a very simple reason. You light up an active sonar and it makes it easier for the enemy to locate you. Now, is that correct or incorrect? Or
Well, they both have their intentions.
Mm-hmm. It's not my specialty. My thought would be that the active sonar may be from pre-positioned sites, and the boat listening is not the one emitting the sonar. Mm-hmm. There are sonar phones located in places, and you just sit there and listen. Mm-hmm. And the diesel boat in shallow waters is not going to be running its diesel. It's going to be running fast, extremely quiet.
Because you have the passive sonar where it's receptivity. You're listening for. And with the active sonar, you are sending from certain points the sound out so that you can detect the position, the bearing, directionality, and so forth of a craft. Yeah.
Yeah, I know with active sonar, you can get range much more easily. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, with passive sonar, you're less detectable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is an interesting position. Well, thank you very much for your questions. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.